I'd like to welcome Christine Massey back to Planet Waves FM, one of my favorite guests in my entire radio career. Christine, welcome.
Eric, it's so nice to talk to you again. It's always a pleasure.
Okay, so you've been in my inbox a lot today because the this debate is now raging over whether viruses exist. This is what it's come to, 2.5 years into this mess. So I'll just warm up who you are in case anyone doesn't remember. They don't have your picture hanging on the wall. Christine Massey has been leading the effort for more than 2 years to coordinate people around the world, getting responses from governments to the question, basically, I'm summarizing, do you have a human sample of this stuff, this SARS-CoV-2 stuff? And they all say no. And this is a question that a lot of people in the COVID truth movement, so-called, don't want to deal with. Have I talked to you since I buttonholed Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and dropped your name at this in this big conference room full of 200 of his donors? I was not a very popular person that night, but what can you do? Asking about, what did he say? At that time, it was 170 responses from governments and institutions saying, no, we don't have a sample. So please take it away for a moment and tell us.
So, okay. So what happened this morning, I'll just back up a little. I'm backing up already. So in South Africa, we have some wonderful colleagues, Ricardo Marmon and Dr. Fayez Kirsten. And they were questioning the whole COVID scenario early on. So in, I believe since April of 2020, they were sending their own Freedom of Information requests to the South African government and asking, I don't know when they started asking about the existence of the virus, but they were questioning, wanting proof, you know, that all, what was going on, all these measures were actually justified. So at some point they were asking about the existence of the virus, and they actually took the government to court over this. Mm-hmm. So they were in court quite some time ago. It was last year, I believe, they finally got to court. And basically the whole focus of their case was show us the virus. And that's the name of their movement, show us the virus. Mm-hmm. We want you did all these things. You have to prove that there's actually a virus. So they went to court, and essentially the case was tossed out because the judge said that it wasn't an urgent matter to figure out if the virus actually exists or not. So they have continued with their quest. They have a couple of things going on in the court still, and they're still very active. So, and then what I'll explain next is there's a group called Panda, and I'm just going to put my reading glasses on, and I'm going to look at my screen a bit so I can get this right. So Panda, I have been hearing about Panda since 2020. I never followed their work because pretty early on I learned from Dr. Andrew Kaufman, I never say his name quite properly, Dr. Andrew Kaufman and other people that the alleged virus hadn't actually been shown to exist. So I never really followed Panda myself, but I would hear about them quite a lot, and this man named Nick Hudson. So if you go to their website, it's Pandata, so it's PANDATA.org, and they describe themselves as a multidisciplinary group of professionals who perceive that the global reaction to COVID and lockdowns in particular was overwrought and damaging to society. So they were set up specifically about COVID, and PANDA stands for Pandemics-Data and Analytics. So they're a group of scientists specifically focusing on pandemics and COVID-19. So their whole analysis is based on the assumption that SARS-CoV-2, the alleged virus, and COVID-19 actually exist. And so recently, Ricardo issued a challenge to Nick Hudson, who's the chairman of PANDA, to debate this issue as to whether or not it actually exists. Mm-hmm. So what happened this morning was I received an email from Dr. Fayez Kirsten, who works closely with Ricardo Marmon. These are the show us the virus people in South Africa. He sent out an email. Nick Hudson replies to Ricardo Marmon's challenge to a public debate. And so this is what we've been talking about this morning, you and I and some of our colleagues, just how humorous and frankly ridiculous Nick's responses were. There's a couple of emails that they were sent out. All the email communications were shared by Ricardo and Dr. Fayez Kirsten. So I don't know if you want me to keep going and
Well,
talk
can I read
about some of
this
the things
particularly
that Nick
salient
said.
paragraph? Can I read this one paragraph
Sure,
written
please do.
by Nick
Yeah.
Hudson, which I thought
Yes.
it was Monty Python. That's how I replied on the email list last night with the "May I have an argument? That'll be 1 quid" sketch on Monty Python, where they have an argument over what an argument is. What's not an argument? An argument's an organized, structured set of propositions. No, it's not. So basically, so Nick Hudson, chairman of Panda, writes, this is a long paragraph, but if you bear with me, it gets very exciting at the end. There's a punchline. It's kind of a shaggy dog story. As Panda, I'll make it bigger, as Panda has documented extensively, the entire COVID narrative, the official narrative regarding COVID, is bogus. So we know where they stand on this. There's no new virus and no deadly virus. Neither lockdowns nor masks work. Early treatment works but was suppressed. The vaccines are nowhere near as safe and effective as presented. The raft of NPIs, what is an NPI?
That I'm not
Okay, it's
sure.
a something.
NPI, no.
Addressing droplet and fomite transmission are pointless because it doesn't exist, meaning fomite and droplet transmission is the it that does not exist. PCR tests do not diagnose a disease. And the entire enterprise of public health has been captured by corporate interests that do not have the public interest at heart. In short, the entire response to this pandemic has been a destructive disgrace, propelled by a dangerous political agenda and only sustained by propaganda and relentless censorship. All of that, they agree with all of that. Okay, with all of that on offer to demolish the narrative, the quote isolation question has always seemed like a red herring. Show me the virus seems a strangely imprecise thing to say about what is essentially a process, not a thing. So,
Yeah. So since when is a virus a process and not a thing? That's a new. I've never actually heard that before.
Well, it reminds me of talking points that came up during the Bush administration, where somehow the Republican talking points memo went out, and on the same day, everybody was saying the word process, process, Condoleezza Rice, all of them. Well, it's a process. To make it seem like, well, we don't have anything to show you here. So process is a kind of a word you stick in when you don't have anything to show them. Well, we're working on it. Don't worry. But the funny thing is, everything he said up to that point supports, it's circumstantial evidence, but it still supports one way to explain all of that is that there's not a virus. That's a
Exactly.
very Occam's razor-ish convenient way. Now, you still need further proofs, but this is the thing. He's taking the same position as many people. Gary Null, for example, takes the same exact position. Everything is bullshit. Everything is phony. None of this is true, except there's a virus.
Right. And I went to Panda's website after seeing this exchange, just to refresh my memory, exactly what is Panda and what have they been saying? And they have a protocol on their, this is their whole thing, is that they give advice to organizations or governments. They give their analysis on what would be an appropriate response to COVID-19. So their whole analysis based on the idea that there is
Is
a virus.
anecdotal
So
disease.
exactly. So in this protocol that they have, I'll just read out, trying to find. They have it, it's just, of course, it's full of references to SARS-CoV-2 and COVID-19 vaccines. They're not against all testing. They understand PCR is not a good test, but then at the same time, they're saying things like define cases using clinical symptoms confirmed by a positive test result. Hospital
that's what the.
testing
I'm sorry. Keep
hospital
going. Keep
testing
going.
should be limited to patients with a characteristic clinical picture. So they're not saying stop testing, they're saying don't test as much, and that alternative tests with high specificity may be used to confirm the result. What alternative tests are they talking
Yeah.
about? There are no validated COVID-19 tests. If you don't have proof of a virus, you obviously can't confirm COVID-19. Then they go on and talk about vaccines, ensure that public transparency of all efficacy and safety data for the vaccines. Vaccination must be fully voluntary. So they're not against the so-called vaccines. They just want it to be transparent and voluntary. So, I mean, I'm asking them. I sent an email. So my head is so scrambled. I think it was last night or maybe it was this morning, asking them, what is this SARS-CoV-2 that you're talking about? What is this COVID-19 that you mentioned 10 times in this protocol? What are these cases that you're talking about? What are these vaccines for? Because if you're not even sure that there's a virus, what are you doing putting yourself forward as a scientific organization that has figured out the appropriate response to COVID-19, but you're
Okay.
not sure if there's a virus?
But let's stick to their language. Show me a virus is a strangely imprecise thing to say about what is essentially a process, not a thing. This is weasel words. It's not an argument. And we, as journalists seeking the truth, really can sum it up in one question: where's your data? The entire position I take as a journalist is, where's your data? That's it. Everything, and that's your whole project,
So
is
well,
where's your
yeah.
data? Show me a study. Where's your data? So it is in fact a very, very precise thing. Now, there was another really funny quote in here about the one with semantics. They don't want to get they don't want to mix it up with lesser minds
Oh, yes.
because all the lesser minds do is worry about semantics.
Yeah, he
So
said
where is
that
that where is
when the
that
late, there's actually two emails from Nick. So if you scroll down a bit through that document, you'll find more. I can read out actually the second email. If you, he's saying what you're asking for is meaningless and
So,
represents a fundamental misunderstanding. Okay, I'll find the semantics
yeah,
part. He says,
say
I
that
remember
slowly.
he's.
He's and this is in response to being asked for the data on the existence of the virus, right? This is an
Yeah.
important question. I mean, just to recap, the first sequence was published around January 10th, 2020. And by March 30th, 2020, there were 4.4 billion people under house arrest. I'm just going to say that again. Okay, this is like a 10-run homer. They had a suspect virus that they announced to the world on approximately January 11th, 2020. And by the end of the quarter, by March 30th, 2020, based on that claim, they had 4.4 billion people, half the planet, under house arrest. Well, they should. All of them, everyone should be forced to provide proof that they did that for a reason. They had some substantiation for that action. I'm not, it's escaping me completely how anyone could think that that's a bad question.
Exactly. And I understand that a lot of groups and a lot of people didn't think to ask that question. It never entered their mind, like myself in the beginning, until I heard from Dr. Andrew Kaufman. It's understandable that that doesn't even enter your mind that there's no virus. But once you're aware of the issue, and he specifically mentioned freedom of information responses in his one of his emails. So he's very aware of this debate, and he says, I found that quote you were talking about.
Yeah, let's hear this one.
So
This was
he's
Mark
okay.
Mark Bailey quoted this last night.
His first, I think this was the first email that he sent to, anyway, one of the emails. His first paragraph, he says, I continue to receive numerous requests to debate with Ricardo. While I have a strong intuition that there are a host of basic science questions that need to be asked about virology, my suggestion is that if there is to be a debate on the subject, we should locate people who are competent to talk to the axiomatic science. I had to look up axiomatic to make sure exactly what that means. And it's something to the line of, to the effect of self-evident. Anyway, so he says he's not competent. So he was competent to set up a scientific organization to analyze the COVID-19 response and everything, you know, that means that entails everything to do with COVID-19. So they're competent to do that, but they're not competent to say, oh, does anybody actually have a sample of this virus? Has anybody actually sequenced it or characterized it or done even one controlled experiment? That he's not competent to enter into. He says, I've noticed that when laymen discuss this issue, they get stuck in semantics. Yeah, and right, so Mark Bailey had the comment on that, that it's not the lay people who change the definition of isolation. Anything. We're simply pointing out that no virus actually has been isolated and that virologists have confused everyone with their publications because they use that word. So we're not getting stuck in semantics. We're simply pointing out that there's been this huge misunderstanding and this huge misconception going on. And he says, from a tactical point of view, these issues are contentious. Well, yeah, and unlikely to be resolved soon. Well, yeah, if nobody will talk about them, even with the right minds involved. Well, apparently he's not one of the right minds because he's not willing to get involved.
An axiom is a statement of self-evident truth.
Yeah, so that to me would imply that the science is self-evident and therefore there's nothing to discuss. I mean, his emails I find quite contradictory, especially when you compare them with what Panda has been saying all along. And how this is a red herring. He thinks this whole issue is a red herring. I don't know how that's possible.
Right. So let's look up red herring.
Red herring is when that one I know. Like that one's when somebody puts out an issue to talk about, but it's really a distraction and it's not it doesn't actually touch, it doesn't really matter. It distracts people from what they really need to be discussing.
Okay. But so the implication of red herring is it's an intentional diversion.
A diversion, yeah.
But intentional.
An intentional diversion.
That's a red herring. You're saying that in an argument that you're just trying to scuttle this whole argument. When no, this is not a diversion. This is the center of the matter. I think it's really a question of courage to ask the question.
Yeah, and if there's no virus, then there's nothing to test for. So simply saying, oh, the tests aren't very good. If you point out, okay, the PCR test, and even if you point out that all the tests that exist are not good, if people still believe in the virus, then they're going to wonder, well, we really don't have any reliable data. We need better tests. You know, we still need to keep going with all this analysis, and it will still leave the fear lingering because we don't have any accurate data. And you'll still have people thinking, well, okay, so there's still a reason to be cautious, and you know, I'll still do my part and get my so-called vaccine because I want to, you know, be responsible and help make sure this virus that we don't actually know much about is not spreading to other people. So that's the whole basis of the entire everything. Mm-hmm. Before you even get to the testing stage, you have to believe there's a virus. If there's no virus, there's nothing to test for.
Or you have a reason to make it look like there's a virus. Now, the thing is, this the virus existence issue is the solution is demonstrated many, many different ways. You know, for example, it is direct evidence for you to have nearly 200 responses on file from all these institutions like the NIH and like CDC and Health Canada and British Health Service and all these places saying we don't have any. So that's one part. Then you look at all of the proofs. Supposedly, there's like 15 studies that I put into my chronology, and all of them are only able to create a artificial intelligence construction of a virus called an in silico virus, a computer construction. Then when you do the most important thing, I think, which is where I started, which is you say, how does the test work? You find out that the test must have what it seeks to find. If it's looking for a daffodil, it must have a daffodil.
Yes.
So then the question is, okay, what are you seeking to find? We're seeking to find a virus. What are you using to find that virus? Well, we're using a bunch of computer code, actually, made from monkey pus and kidney cells and cancer cells, and we're just shaking that up and throwing it into a computer, and it's saying, look, there's your virus, in a computer only. So there's three different pillars to this discussion. There's the outright denials, there's the lack of actual demonstration in all of the studies. They're all in silico, mixed up, computer generated, and then you look at the test and examine the requirements to show the test is valid. You must have some of the stuff you're looking for. So I don't see how anyone can get away from these three pillars. Now, it's not just like maybe there's some misunderstanding on the work you're doing. Okay, maybe you got a hangover all this time. All right, let's go to the original studies, Andy Kaufman's department. And a lot of people have said this. Even Wolfgang Wolfdog has said, no, I looked at all these original studies from the Reiner Fulmic Investigation Committee. No, I heard him say this in an early video. No, they never did the work to show there is one. You look at what they did do. It's all mega hit, blast, Trinity. It's all CGI. It's Lucasfilms making the Death Star. There's no Death Star. It's a thing in a computer code. With little spaceships flying around in computer code. Okay, and then we look at the test. The test requires an actual sample. It's not just enough that you seem to get a synchronicity between somebody who seems to be sick and this bullshit test. That bullshit test should have gone through every step in the process to prove they are testing for the right thing. And this is not an academic exercise. They lock down half the world under martial law in less than 90 days. Come on.
Yes.
This is serious stuff. I mean, I'm laughing, but it's fucking ridiculous.
We have to laugh to keep our sanity. That's the only way to stay sane. So we're not laughing because we don't care. We don't get how horrific it is. It's to the point, it's so absurd. And we've been at this for so long and we're tired and, you know, we're just trying to keep going here. So, and like you're saying, so all the tests, like Dr. Stefan Langa points out, all these so-called virus isolation and sequencing studies disprove themselves.
Yes.
Because you just read their methods and they disprove themselves. They didn't discover a virus. They just made up a genome. Like you said, they pointed at little particles. Well, no one's disputing if little particles exist. The question is, does a disease-spreading virus exist? So pointing at particles doesn't cut it. And the virus, you know, the culturing is just silly. So the studies disprove themselves. And then we have the CDC admitting in their own documentation that there was no virus sample available to develop the PCR tests. Mm-hmm. And then there's the Corman and Drosten publication where they put forward this protocol for the PCR test, and they admitted that they developed that without actually having a sample of the virus.
Yeah,
so,
and what they did have...
So we know there's no misunderstanding.
Right.
I'm sorry?
Yeah, and what they did have was a bunch of computer code called SARS and MERS, and they just sort of like cut and pasted it together, and they called it a novel virus. To be a pandemic, it has to be a novel virus. That's what in the definition of a pandemic. Well, that's why cancer's not a pandemic. It's not a novel thing. It's been around forever, basically, not in these numbers. So to meet the definition of a pandemic, the current definition, it must be a new thing. And they take all this old stuff with no proof, and they say, oh, old stuff equals new thing. I mean, it's really... Old wine in new bottles doesn't cut it. And old wine is usually good. But this is what they're saying here.
Yes, and in that Corman and Drosten publication, you know, just within the framework of believing in viruses, because that's where they were coming from, even they admitted in their publication that they expected that test to cross-react,
yes,
or in other words, also test positive for any
Asian viruses.
Yeah, they expected it to test. Yeah, they specifically mentioned the imaginary SARS virus from 2003 and all Asian coronaviruses or all Asian viruses. They said it right there. And that was actually, that was one of the ways that they also tested the sensitivity of that. They did it two ways, if I remember correctly. One was they used synthetic transcripts or whatever they call it that they produce based on the in silico genome from
China. And the other way, nucleotide technology.
Yes. And then the other way they tested it was they used some frozen stock of the fake 2003 SARS virus. They used it as well. That was one of the ways that they tested the sensitivity of the test. Yeah, it's right there in their publication that was published in Eurosurveillance that the 22 health scientists completely trashed in a review based on 10 major flaws, and they tried to get it retracted, and the journal refused to retract it. And if I remember correctly, either Corman or Drosten are on the editorial board of that journal.
Yes.
So.
Yes. Yeah, which is not uncommon. But the thing only got like 24 hours peer review. One of the people commenting on that said there are so many graphs and diagrams that it would have taken longer than 24 hours to typeset the publication and set up all of the graphs and diagrams. And they had the whole thing approved in 24 hours. Peer review means you find the flaws in the thing and you debate the flaws. It doesn't just mean you rubber stamp it.
Yeah, and I have been through that process because I used to work as a statistician with cancer researchers. So I collaborated. I was a co-author on cancer research studies. And so I knew, and that was one of the things that was really suspicious for me with this whole COVID phenomena early on, was seeing all these publications coming forward so quickly. And I was like, how is that possibly happening? Because I remember how long, you know, just in the beginning stages of all the meetings and trying to figure out, okay, what are we even going to measure? What is our research question? You know, getting everything in place to even get started. And then you have to, if it was a clinical trial, you would have to go through that. But even if you're using pre-existing data, you have to get the permission. You have to get the data. You have to clean the data. You have to do all the analysis. Yeah. Then you have to write up a report. You have people looking at drafts and making edits. Like you said, like it's a process, and that's before you even submit it to a journal. Like it just goes on and on and on. Mm-hmm. So it was really strange to see all these publications coming out claiming to have all this insight into this alleged new virus.
Fast. Approximately, I would say about 8 by early February, falsely claiming isolation of the virus. And when you look at it, and see, I am lucky that I learned all of this on my own. Like, it's lovely to know everyone I'm involved with now and using as my awesome collaborators and sources. But I was using off-menu sources on this and probed into the test, and then was introduced to David Bettini, who is one step back from the review paper. He's a friend of Bobby Malhotra, who's the virus visualizer on that. He's the number 2 author. So I was figuring this out on my own, so that when I was given the findings and I saw the Corman-Drosten paper and I started studying Kaufman and Cowan's work, I already understood but was given better language for it.
Mm. Yeah, Bettini, that's interesting because I used to be on Twitter with him. There was sort of a group of us, and Bobby used to be part of it.
Yeah, that's
and
how they
Bobby
met.
Bobby was right with us in the whole, you know, saying that there was no virus. You know, he was adamant about that. But then when he got involved with that Corman-Drosten review, then he decided to take a different tactic, and he stopped talking about the fact that there isn't even a virus. But he was right there with us for a long time. adamant that there was no virus.
Yes, he was calling it, when I was working with him, he was calling it a phantom virus.
Phantom virus.
But if that's even a compliment. I mean, and I know that I'm trying to keep putting myself in the mind of someone listening to this, because certain questions do come up, like, how are people getting sick? But this is a ridiculous question in a world where we're poisoned and where people are getting sick all the time. I can't point the camera at my scanner, but I listen to EMS radio all the time. Kate, have you still got audio and video on me? Kate, Christine was lagging for a second. And so I listen when I drive. I listen at my desk. I live in a rural area. Okay, it is the biggest land. It's like one of the lowest per capita populations in New York State. And the ambulances are going around the clock taking people to the hospital. And it's not for COVID. It's for every other thing. General illness, not feeling well, difficulty breathing, injuries from a fall, injuries from a pre-existing fall, fever, you name it. It is like a fleet of ambulances shuttling people to the Kingston Hospital around the clock. What are people getting sick from? Where's anyone been? People are getting sick all the time. So that's not an argument against the existence of a virus. In fact, when you're going to lock up 4.4 billion people, you better have a reason you can prove. Just saying. Anyone not agree with that? Please continue, Christine.
Sorry, no. You know what? I'm out in the country, and it was lagging again, so I missed what you just said there for the last minute or so. Sorry.
Got it. Well, it'll be on the assuming it recorded, which I think it did. It'll be in the audio. But I was basically saying is when you're going to lock up 4.4 billion people, you should be able to show why you did it, and the reason should be comprehensible.
Yeah, and that should be, you know, what the lawyers and all these groups should be pouncing on is, I cannot understand why they're not pouncing on this and demanding, you know, making this the focus of their work. Then you and I could get a rest. We could think about something else for a while.
Look, I think it's a good question. I mean, I wonder what this is about, especially when I see them taking these completely ridiculous positions, doing the two left feet shoes tied together dance that RFK did, or that Reiner Fumlich did a couple of weeks ago. I went on for 40 minutes dismantling this completely ridiculous argument he's making about why the test is inaccurate and unreliable, but not admitting that the only reason why it's inaccurate and unreliable, the only reason, is that there's no primers. And no primers means no virus. Mm. I happen to think that's a better approach than just coming out and saying that there's no virus. Because there's a runway. There's a lead-in. There's like, well, how do you know there's a virus when there is one? Well, you would know because you have a sample of it and you can look for that thing elsewhere. Right? This is not like a search and rescue dog where you take the dog out on 40 acres and say, find me a corpse. We need to find the exactly right thing we know is doing the thing we say it's doing. That's what the health establishment should be ready to produce. So that's one approach. They don't understand why the test is not valid. This is what dogs me, speaking of dogs.
Mm. Well, yeah, and I mean, there's so many flaws with that test that even if there was a virus, it would be a ridiculous test. But when you know that they don't even have a gold standard. I mean, that's a very simple way to put it. Where is your gold standard?
Well, and the gold standard
that you calibrate this test.
You know you're testing for the right thing. That's the gold standard.
That's it.
Is you know you've got the culprit.
Yeah. And nobody has it. So here we are.
It's not an innocent before proven guilty thing.
Yeah. And, you know, this is one of the arguments that Nick is making. Well, basically, he's saying he's putting the onus on Ricardo to supply an alternate theory, basically to disprove the idea that there's a virus. And, you know, Ricardo pointed out in his, I'm just going to pull up his little document here. If I, hopefully I didn't close it. Might have to find it in my email again. But he was pointing out how this is, you know, a common sort of response that we're getting. I'm just looking through my emails here to try to find it. This is a common strategy that, or response that we're getting from people is that, you know, they're trying to put the onus on us. And I had the same thing recently. I had a email exchange with Dr. Michael Yeadon because how did it start? I think someone sent me a video where he was talking about the virus as though it exists. And he did make a comment about the no virus people. And he made some brief comments to the fact like, if it even exists, you know. But for the most part, in this interview that I believe went for over an hour, he was continually talking about virus and viruses and pandemics. And he said that coronaviruses caused the common cold. So despite having made those little remarks, he basically spoke as though viruses do exist and that he knows this. And so I wrote to him and I said, you know, I know you're tired of being asked about this because he has said it before. And I have corresponded with him a bit before, but still, I said, you know, as long as you keep making these comments, you're going to be challenged for proof of the virus. And he tried to turn it back on me, and I saw he did it again with someone else. He's basically saying, well, I can't say that unless I can prove that there's no virus, and it's impossible to prove a negative. So what am I supposed to do?
But
This
wait,
is a
this is the wait, where are
scientist
there?
that's saying
Well, right.
this.
So go back to your proof of the existence of the thing. What, you know, it's really ridiculous because based on the standard, you could claim the existence of anything.
Exactly,
And you
exactly. And
don't
this is a
prove that.
scientist acting as though he's helpless in this situation. Oh, he literally said to me, like, what can I do? And you know, myself and others have said, you don't need, well, you wrote to him too and said, no one's asking you to prove a negative. It's not about that. It's about putting the onus is on the people who are saying that there is a virus to prove it. And they have nothing whatsoever, absolutely nothing. So Ricardo, he was pointing this out, the burden of proof, logical fallacy, which is commonly employed, and he's calling it a psyop tactic. I'm not accusing Nick Hudson in particular or Panda or anybody else of, you know, being part of the cabal or that they're purposely using a psyop tactic, but it is a psyop tactic that is used by the cabal, and it's to win arguments by shifting the burden of the proof from themselves, who made the claim that a virus or whatever, that something exists, to the victims who suffer because of the false claim. So the burden of proof rests with the cabal to prove their claim. It's not on us. If there's no proof that the virus exists, then their claim is false and invalid. There is no burden of proof that shifts to us, the people. Those who propagate the cabal's burden of proof logical fallacy regarding SARS-CoV-2 are causing confusion and misleading the people. This is a very serious matter, a matter of life and death. Those were Ricardo Marmon's remarks on this kind of argument that we're getting. And I, like I said, I'm not accusing Nick Hudson or anybody else in particular of being part of the cabal. But the point that Ricardo is making that this is a very serious matter and the burden of proof is not on us. So please, Nick Hudson, Dr. Mike Yeadon, and all the other people out there who are trying to make it out as though the burden is on us, it is not. It is not. And you are going along with this false narrative, not 100%, obviously, but you are going along with the idea that. That viruses exist and that these virus isolation and sequencing methods that have been used are actually legitimate when they're nothing of the sort. So please get on the right side of history and stop trying to put the burden on us and talking about us as though we're these silly, ridiculous, annoying people, or that we're, what did they say, that we're causing a rift in the movement and that sort of thing. No, we're on the side of truth, and don't expect us to unite under lies and nonsense and anti-science.
Yeah, and so I would say, as a journalist, I'm on the side of show me the truth. This is my, and I mean, this is right in my editorial policy, printed on my website, and it's something that I've talked about since the early days when I was doing toxins investigations. The one question that the journalist must ask is, where's your data? And this is the question for activists as well. Anybody claiming to have authority as a scientist or a doctor or being in a position of some public responsibility can always be asked, where's your data?
Yes. Yeah. And that's really important lesson for us to all learn. And it will help us in so many, so many issues. Mm-hmm. For example, the water fluoridation that I worked on and all these issues. I mean, yeah, where's mm-hmm. your proof?
So now you're up to, now we are building a body of proof in various ways. My work on the test, your work on the FOIL request. How many are you up to now? How many of these institutions and governments have said, it's probably near 200 now, right?
Yeah. On my website, we have 190, and I have many emails from people that I haven't even opened yet. There's more institutions. We have a lady in the UK who's been asking a lot of the municipalities there in England. Mm-hmm. And I'm just looking in my Excel file. Something from Sweden that John Blade is someone who helps out and is quite outspoken about this. He sent me a response from Sweden. I haven't even had a chance to upload that yet. And numerous municipalities in England. And like I said, there's a few other emails that I haven't even opened yet. So mm-hmm. I'm sure we'll be up to 200 in no time.
When
and I know there's
email,
at least
you check
one
your email.
Yeah, once I get caught up with my emails, I got a little distracted. I guess it was last night that email came in about Nick Hudson and Panda.
I just got another of these master fence sitters, or the Brownstone incident, the Brownstone Institute, and a alert just floated in. What is the value of a COVID test? See if I can find a salient paragraph the first time I'm looking through this.
And what is the Brownstone Institute?
They were the outgrowth of what was the statement that was made. I think it was in late 2020, a statement by a bunch of professionals, doctors and scientists, where it said these lockdown measures are wrong, they're overdone, but I forget the name of the statement. It was the Great Barrington Statement.
Oh.
So the Great Barrington Statement becomes the Brownstone Institute.
Okay.
And they're not, I've gone back and forth with the founder on this, and he's another one who won't touch the issue. So we have to ask, I think we really need to be looking at this from a psychological and spiritual perspective. Why is this the third rail? What is it about this that's the third rail?
Meaning, why are they so stubborn?
Well, no,
is that
why?
What you mean?
The third rail issue, maybe it's an American term. The third rail is where you get electrocuted.
Okay.
Trains have two rails the tracks roll on, and some have a third rail for where the power comes from. And if you touch the third rail, you get fried. You ground out and you get electrocuted. And so, whereas there's a third rail issue, it's a thing that people won't touch.
Yeah,
and
okay.
I don't think we can be asking this from a scientific standpoint, because all of the actual science, the logic, the documented evidence, the studies showing that that supposedly prove their claim of isolation all fall flat. The test falls flat. All three pillars stand. So when you get someone like Jeff, what's his name, at the Brownstone Institute, or you get a guy like Mike Yaden, what are they really defending? What are they trying to hold up? What is it that, and how is it serving them? Yeah, from a therapy standpoint, you have to also ask, you know, how does it serve them, and what are they protecting?
Well, you know, I was thinking about this the other day, and I realized, you know, it's easy for everybody to take a stand against the government and say, you know, the response was overblown, and criticize them on the injections, criticize them in mm-hmm. all the different aspects. But when you, because that clamp down was coming from governments. But when you step into this realm that we are in of actually questioning the foundational science of the existence of the virus, this is now going to touch on a lot more than just the governments, right? I mean, I guess most of these virologists work in government-funded institutions, but it's more of a basic science thing, and it's going to... I mean, there's all these scientists around the world who went along with the idea of viruses all this time. So the question, criticizing the response to the fake pandemic, you know, you're criticizing the government and perhaps these pharmaceutical companies with their fake injections, you know, they want to modify our genes. That's easy for most people to speak out about.
Right.
But when you're getting to this like basic science thing, that's like, I guess, really embarrassing for a lot of people, because there's been a lot of scientists in all these years. Think of the huge amount of effort that has gone on in the scientific community of looking at, and even the people who've been outspoken about the injections, the so-called vaccines, for years. You know, maybe it's embarrassing for them too, that like, oh, all these years, you know, we were missing the core issue ourselves. You know, it like, maybe it's embarrassing for them, and it's too sensitive a topic for too many people. Mm-hmm. Whereas simply criticizing the governments and the pharmaceutical companies, that's not so touchy for a lot of people.
Right.
And Mike Keaton was, you know, he was a respiratory disease scientist at Pfizer. So for him, let's just assume that he genuinely believed all these years that viruses exist. And now we're pointing out, hey, that's actually wrong. You know, I guess that's embarrassing for someone like him. Mm-hmm. And it's embarrassing to a lot of people, a lot of people in the scientific community.
And citizens, too. Ordinary folks. I mean, I had one friend say to me, you're not going to say to me there's no such thing as a communicable disease, are you? I'm like, well, why don't we just ask the question? I don't have to say there is or isn't. Why don't we just ask the question if there's such a thing?
Right.
And look honestly at the evidence and see what we find.
Yeah, I think it must... I mean, and think of all these doctors too, like that a lot of them, they've been injecting people all these years and now we're asking them to admit, like, we don't even have to discuss what the harms might, well, get caught up in all these issues of discussing different studies about how safe or effective it was. We're telling you there wasn't even a virus for you to protect anybody from. So that's gotta, I mean, I wouldn't want that on my conscience. And you know, I mean, this is how our society works, that people, it's very much based on, and largely out of necessity. Nobody has the time or the energy to investigate every single thing. So we have a lot of beliefs that we carry around from trusted sources. And it's, you know, and that's how, and I think in medicine, though, there, you know, of course, there's a lot of corruption, and doctors are intentionally kept incredibly busy from the time they start medical school. So they don't have time to question and, you know, go doing extra research. They're so busy already just trying to keep up with what is required of them just to get through. And then when they get into practice and they're, so, you know, expected to see so many patients, you know, every single hour, I don't know how they do it. So anyway, what was I getting at? That I wouldn't want to have to live with that on my conscience, that, you know, I was just... I just trusted all these years, and I injected all these people, children and adults, even babies, you know, all these years, all these jabs, all these things going in their bodies. And not only did I not even know what it was or what it was really doing to people, but now I have to face the fact that there wasn't even a virus to protect those people from. That's got to hurt. So, yeah, I guess it's not surprising there's a lot of resistance. And then you said all the parents, you know, having guilt. You know, a lot of parents will be feeling badly now that they have to face that they just went along and trusted and had their children jabbed. I mean, I had my son jabbed. I remember one time when he was really little, and I stopped doing it at some point, but I did it too, you know, and I wish I hadn't. But
right.
So I think, you know, there's just a lot of people are going to have to face their own actions, their own decisions that they have made in their life. And I guess it's painful for people too. I think that's why, compared to everybody just piling on the government and saying, and the government's, acting ridiculous and these crazy companies that want to inject us with and change our DNA. Most people can get on board with that, but I guess we're challenging people at a deep level, and it's got to hurt a lot of people. I mean, I just look at it as like it's wonderful news to find out there aren't viruses, because it's like, yay, we don't have to worry about that. Nature is so much nicer than we thought. We don't have these little threats. There's plenty of things that we do have to be concerned about, but viruses isn't one of them. So I just tend to look at it as, it's wonderful news, but and I mean, I don't. If everybody's going to have to go through their own journey and face whatever they have to face within themselves, and so I don't know. I look at it. My job is just to tell the truth, and people have to work out, their own inner emotions that they have around it. That's their job to deal with that part. But maybe this is why we're having such a hard time. Basically, asking a lot of doctors and scientists to admit incompetence and ignorance, and that they just went along with something.
And it opens up the whole can of worms on toxins, which you never hear talked about.
For sure, for sure, for sure. Because, like John Rappaport is pointed out really effectively many times, that these alleged viruses serve as a really great cover story for the real, which I'm sure you know very well. So,
Sure, every time
yeah.
something goes wrong, it's blamed on a virus. And
Yeah.
the same people making the
Mm-hmm.
drugs, the same industry making the drugs to so-called inoculate and or cure the virus are the same ones that are also making all the pollutants. And we haven't even, there's a lot of questions we have not asked, but it is easy to see the whole thing serves as a huge distraction from the matter of toxins and what actually makes people sick.
Yeah. And imagine, like, think of all these resources that have been put in all these decades studying these alleged viruses and antiviral drugs and antivirus this, virus that, especially now with COVID, and energy being put into, oh, remember how there was such a like a panic over we're not gonna have enough ventilators, we don't have enough masks, like all this energy, all this human energy and all these resources that went to something that doesn't even exist. When we liberate that, it's going to be so incredible. Like, all that time and energy can be directed to things that are actually useful when people understand the truth. And I'm sure that's why this is one of the reasons. And one thing I want to do soon when I get a chance is write an article, and maybe we could collaborate on our reasons why we do stick with this issue. And that's one of them. It's like what you just said, it's distracting people from what's really going on. So I think we have a lot of
And prevents doing the work. I mean, from a therapy standpoint, you always have to ask how this serves someone's purpose. What's it convenient for? And it is the scrim works many different ways. Right? As long as you believe all you have to do is get an injection to keep you healthy, you're unlikely to do a lot of other things and question all the other ways in which you may be harming yourself. And you're just like, oh, well, I got my shot. I'm good.
Right, exactly.
Christine, thank you
So
so much.
humanity will be so much
Yes.
better off. Yeah,
Well,
we'll be so much better off.
look, it's pushed this question out. And I think that the what does Bill call them? Virus pushers against clot shots.
Yes. Our great friend Bill Houston,
Bill
William
Houston, the
Houston,
man in
he
the
doesn't, he's
background.
always there in the background supporting us and keeping us on track, and he doesn't get the acknowledgement. So shout out to our friend Bill.
Yes. Is that their drama defending this, they're drawing the wagons in a circle, Joe Mercola bringing Jeremy Hammond onto the program, and they're both gonna have a real argument. They're gonna both argue the same side without any facts. This is a spectacle. It's a spectacle, and there's always an educational process. And as T.S. Eliot said in one of his last poems, "Humankind cannot bear very much reality," and I keep reminding myself of that. But you can, Christine. Thank you for making many appearances on Planet Waves FM and doing this incredible reporting work that you're doing. You, in my opinion, get the Citizen Journalist of the Century Award for doing this original work with your team around the world.
Oh, you're so sweet, Eric. I came across your website early on. Thank you to you. You're amazing.
Good.
And we're going to get it done.
Good.
Thank you.
Okay.
God bless.
Bye for now.
Bye-bye.
Mute, stop video. Good. All right. Is Kate there?